Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's time for another meeting of our book club. And Larry Mueller Show Book Club, we have a criteria for it. First, it should be a good book, but it should be also set in Wisconsin, or it should have a Wisconsin author, or both. And we have the trifecta here with Michael Knadler, the author of our book today. He grew up in a Wisconsin River village. He lives a few miles from the river in rural Dodgeville. Michael taught high school in Dodgeville for 30 years, during which time he published a novel for teens. That one was called Callie's Way Home. And as we talk with him about his latest novel, it's titled Bridgeton. What are your memories growing up in a small town in Wisconsin? Have you spent lots of time on the Wisconsin River, maybe? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Again, love to hear from you. Michael Knadler, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Larry. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, I was privileged to read your book, and I enjoyed it very much. What inspired you to write it?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about the origins, and it really began in my teaching career when I had lots of students who were interested in varying degrees to what I might be saying. And I would tell them stories to interest them, entertain them, also to try to inspire them to write better narrative essays. And so I would present instances from my past, some made up, some exaggerated, but you know that's how storytelling works. And so I had a few of those made it into the book, some didn't. But then after I retired, I started writing some of those stories down. They were about these boys when they were 10 years old. And in that process, the three characters who inhabit this book arose out of my imagination, Mickey, Jimbo, and Lemon. And they and so that it was, in the beginning, just a coming-of-age story, which are very common types of fiction. Mm-hmm. And then as I morphed it into their lives as young teenagers and older teenagers, I said, I'm going to go for this. I'm going to take them to my age, which was around 70. And so then I strategically started presenting episodes, creating episodes that took them in along the way with those passages in the adult world, you know, what happens after you get out of high school, marriages, having children, the work you do, and then inevitably the deaths that are around you. And so it became a story of time passing and death arising. And there are a number of deaths that I handle and that affect these characters. But in the end, they come together as 70-year-olds, not in Bridgeton, which is where they grew up, but in the Twin Cities, and they are, in a sense, have turned inward and are good friends who will sustain each other, theoretically, until they themselves die.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach you took. I was fascinated this as I was reading along. I was thinking, you know, almost every chapter could be a short story in and of itself.
Yeah, no, they function that way, and there are some threads that that go through it, and most of the key characters have a follow-up, kind of a coda at some point in the last part of the book to see what happens to them. But they are, but the key characters, particularly Mickey, who's the narrator for most of it, they sustain it as they experience these relationships. It's, you know, it's very much a character study of these three boys who grow into men.
Yeah. If take us on a trip through Bridgeton. if you were to walk around Bridgeton, what would you see?
Well, Bridgerton, in a sense, is modeled after my hometown of Mosinee. And amusingly, I had one friend who read the book, and when he was done, he said he spent several hours Googling Bridgerton and could not find it. So that was kind of a compliment to me. But it's a paper mill town. It was when I was growing up in the 50s and early 60s. I lived a block away from the river and the bridge, and if you are looking at the book, the picture of the bridge on the cover, which spans the front and the back cover, that is the bridge that I grew up with. And in the book, I affectionately refer to it as Old Iron, but as a kid, that was never the case. So across the river was the paper mill, which was the lifeblood of the town. And part of the river ran down to a power plant. And the downtown had a couple grocery stores. My father, who was a small-town doctor, had his office there next to my grandfather's office, and my grandfather owned a small telephone company. And so I use references to those in the book. There was a skating rink, which is featured in a number of the stories.
Yeah.
At Desert Park. There was a place that we used to prowl around in called Skunk Hollow, which was reinvented for this book. And, you know, the schools were small. The grade school, which was right across the street from the Catholic grade school, they inhabited the same playground. And so it was small-town America, 1,400 people or so when I was growing up. And rarely did we think of going to Wausau or Stevens Point, which were the meccas that we would go to on those special occasions. Now, Mosinee has become more like a bedroom community for Wausau.
Yeah, which shows up kind of in the book.
Yes,
near the end. Well, and characters, I mean, you've got the three main characters, and they all come from families, of course. I looked up, I counted. There are 33 characters from within the families. And then there's another dozen or so that aren't members of the family, but many of those dozen play an important role in the book. How'd you manage all those characters? You know, it was interesting to me how you managed them. But when you're writing something like that, and I will also say, I love the fact that in the beginning, you list the characters by family. And I'll admit, there's more than a couple times that I went back because I'd forgotten a particular Daisy. Where's Daisy again? I could go right back and, oh, of course, find that.
Yeah, that was actually my wife's suggestion, so I compliment her on that. But there were a number of people who said, I was so happy you had that, the listing of the characters. But juggling the characters was never too hard, and the fact that I knew for most of them, they would reappear in some future moment when they were adults and we'd pick up on who they were later on was something that made it easier to juggle them. They weren't just one-offs. A few are one-off characters, but for the most part, the key people reappear at least a second time, and that made it comfortable for me to do further development with their character.
Couple of comments. Nancy sent us a note, read Bridgerton last year, loved it so much that she put it on her Kindle after owning the hard copy. The storyline initially took her back to when one of the biggest issues for a preteen was whether or not they would have to be home before the streetlights came on. And Nancy appreciates how, Michael, how you revisit the various characters as they navigate the changes and the impacts on their town. And by the time the story ended, she felt a kinship with the main characters. It was like wrapping herself in a favorite cardigan, which is nicely put. The perspective of the main character change in alignment with the development changes he underwent was interesting. Even the verbiage and the style seemed to transition from the linguistic level of preteen to adult. Was that intentional, is her question?
Well, part of it certainly was. The early stories when the boys are 10. There's maybe eight or nine when the boys are 10 years old and pretty much amazed by life, even though some of them, particularly Jimbo, is going through some trauma. But as they become older, the experience they have are more sophisticated. Their thinking becomes more sophisticated. There's a story in there called Fragments, which is kind of about Mickey becoming a writer to some extent. And his mentor tells him, you know, keep at it, and fragments, your fragments in your mind will become longer and longer sentences as your voice speaks to you, which then transitions into him kind of writing his first story. And that story is about one of the few things in the book which is real, about my Aunt Margaret, who was severely burned in a Halloween accident.
Mm.
And but he's writing about what he knows about. And so that one was somewhat easy for me to take on, even though my aunt has been dead for many years. But yeah, the stylistic thing becomes more sophisticated. And then as they contemplate the mortality issues as they get older, you know, the thoughts become very complicated.
Yeah.
As it does for all of us.
Yeah. Oh, she's also wondering if there's a sequel, and is there an audio version? Did you? You have a great voice, by the way. You could do the audio on it, I think.
Well, there's no audio version. If you want to invite me to your book group, I'd be very happy to drop my voice in.
Well, you know, there's some more emails here, but you ought to drop your voice in. Do you have got something you'd read for us from the book?
Oh, sure, yeah. And what I'll read is, it's a passage from the second chapter. And this actually did happen, and I'll talk about that after I read the passage, about a good example of how I used a real event in my life as part of a storyline. Okay, so here we go. It's the story of a little baby found on the kitchen table in Mickey's home. Mickey's spending the night with his friend Jimbo, and Jimbo's father is the town doc McPherson. So here we go. I was sleeping on the carpeted floor in Jimbo's bedroom when I first heard the wailing. I rolled over to go back to sleep, but her crying ascended through the heating grate near my head. Jimbo and Lemon were buried in sleeping bags across the floor, still breathing deeply. I rose and slowly opened the door, pausing on the stairs when I heard Doc McPherson's soothing voice, "I'm so sorry, Bev." I peered into the kitchen lit only by the under-the-cupboard fluorescent. Beverly Schuster was shuddering and gasping. Doc's flashlight inspected Lucy, the naked baby on the table, Beverly's two-month-old infant. She lay motionless on her back in the middle of a turquoise blanket. The movement of Doc's light beckoned as Beverly leaned forward against the kitchen table, her hands clutching Lucy's legs, stroking them, pinching them. Lucy was soundless with a dull bluish skin tone. She drew me closer by her inactivity. Beverly rubbed Lucy's belly, pleading with her, "Lucy, wake up." I stood next to Doc as he tried to console her. "She was dead within seconds after she stopped breathing," Doc said. "I had just nursed her 20 minutes earlier. It can happen that quickly." When I reached out toward Lucy, Doc's oversized paw enveloped my hand and pulled it back. Beverly noticed me for the first time and half smiled through her tears. "Hi, Mickey. It's okay. You can touch her. Here, let me help." She cupped my right hand in both of hers. We fondled Lucy's fingers, sliding up her mottled arm to her fleshy neck. Beverly was no longer crying, whispering at my earlobe, "Feel her face." I looked back at Doc, Lemon in front of him now, uncombed blonde hair, sweeping over his forehead, Jimbo, burly and nearly a head taller than Lemon and I, at his dad's shoulder, both of them fully awake, saucer-eyed in awe at our first encounter with death. Lucy's eyes were half-closed, unfocused, her mouth barely open at the corners. I caressed her velvet cheek with my index finger. My thumb felt no air from her nose, and the heat fleeing her body seemed palpable. Beverly sang lullaby and goodnight as she lifted my hand away and scooped Lucy up. She held her near my face, then Lemon's, finally Jimbo's. "See," She stopped breathing, just like that. Doc, unnerved now by Beverly's actions, spoke very faintly, "Boys," and we moved to the back wall of the kitchen. 3 10-year-olds in white briefs, speechless, lit up by the faint tangerine of dawn edging through the kitchen windows. Doc finally escorted Beverly and Lucy away from us into his office. A version of that actually happened to me. I was 12, and it was summertime, as it is for these boys, and I heard some noise from the kitchen, and I walked down, and my father was there with the woman who was his office worker in his small-town doctor's office. And she was wailing, and my dad was trying to comfort her. And her baby was on the table dead. It died of what they called then crib death, now called SIDS. And I didn't do anything more than just observe.
Yeah.
The rest of the story that I've created here is manufactured for the benefit of the story and the character development. But certainly it's a memory that has stayed with me.
You know, I'm glad you chose that piece. Because it's a beautiful piece of writing. And very touching. And here I see an email from Jane. "The oftentimes poetic language and reminiscent storyline were really engaging. It was sort of like vignettes that you could be read on their own." And she's going to recommend Bridgeton to her book club because they are all from this time period of the story, which of course started in the 50s.
Right. Well, get a hold of me. I'd be very happy to join you in the book club discussion.
Our guest today, Michael Knader, his book is Bridgeton, the title. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts. We have some more emails here as well, but you can join us at 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. On WPR News, it's the Larry Mueller Show Book Club, and our book club selection this time around is from Michael Knadler. He has written the book Bridgeton, a wonderful novel of basically of three friends growing up in a small town, the town of Bridgeton, along the Wisconsin River. Questions or comments for him, or maybe an experience of your own to share, the number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And you were going to make a comment, and I just sort of broke in.
Well, one of the things I was going to comment on was... I think it would be natural for many readers to believe this is my memoir.
Yes. Well, I was going to ask you about that.
Because I've, in a sense, deliberately thrown in a bunch of cues that would make somebody believe that. And in fact, towards the end of the book, I even mentioned as Mickey's trying to wrap up this book as he's 70 years old, that he's trying to put the final touches on this memoir. But it's not a memoir. It's the spirit of it is a memoirish for sure.
Yeah.
But the only a few instances in my past made it into the book, and only a couple of characters. The rest is pretty much my own invention. But I think there's a lot of reasons why people fall in love with memoirs, especially people of a certain age, as Larry and I are sitting here, because we become very reflective when we reach a certain point in life about all the things that have happened to us, good and joyful and sometimes sorrowful, back to when we were young and maybe they were pivotal moments in our life and sent us in a different direction, or when we're older, and that often relates to somebody important to us leaving us, often by death. And so it was very moving for me as a writer and very entertaining as well to write about those moments as these three guys move on from just being Bridgeton buddies to becoming adult friends.
Yeah. I'll tell you on myself, I grew up with, I had three friends, boys, that were friends of mine, and two of them have passed away. Roger is still left. But we did a lot of, you know, similar things. I mean, going out, and there was a hill that we would kind of run, go up at night sometimes in the summertime and just take a blanket and lay down and go to sleep and spend the night there. And our friendship has lasted. And the other two, Dick and Jerry, they're passed away now. But, I mean, we've all were friends for all those years.
Yeah, it's such a common phenomenon. And some people aren't that lucky, like you were and are, to have friends that you sustain through the years. Often those friendships end at when high school graduation occurs. But you know, this is very much a story of friendship and how friendship sustains each other through the ups and downs of life. And so it was fun. The places along the river, as I mentioned, I grew up for most of my time in Mosinee, a block away from the river. And so the bridge was essentially my backyard. But not every place I use in the book, like Discovery Beach, for instance, that was not a part of my youth. In fact, Discovery Beach is more akin to the beaches along the sandbars of the river from Prairie du Sac on down to the Mississippi, where there's no more dams after Prairie du Sac. But you know, Bridgeton, as Mosinee is and was, is part of that whole paper mill dam culture of dams creating flowages, and so there aren't really so many little private beaches like there are as Discovery beaches. But it appears in the very first story, it appears in the last story, and several others in between. So it's one of those gathering points.
You know, and the river, do you feel like the river is almost a character in the book?
Yeah, very much. That was intentional. And even when they leave, the boys leave, when they come back, that's what draws them to do something special. You know, and when Lemon and Mickey come back to disperse the ashes of Aggie Robinson, the former sister Mary Agnes, she requests that they disperse her ashes with the sand that she collected from this little beach. They go to the river. And the river is very much the spirit of what these guys carry within them.
Liz called but couldn't stay with us. She's wondering how you were inspired to create the characters with some mental issues, like Dirty Joe or the troubled kid from high school.
Well, there were several of those. I mean, Dirty Joe just kind of arose. I mean, I wanted to deal with...
It's an interesting character, by the way.
Yeah, I wanted to deal with the phenomenon of PTSD from the World War II phenomenon.
Yeah.
Because often that is disregarded as, you know, it was the good war. Nobody suffered when they came back home like they did from Vietnam or the Mideast Wars. So Dirty Joe was this gentleman who was basically spent 3 years in a prison camp in the Philippines and suffered for the rest of his life until he got into a better place. He had to leave Bridgeton to do it. And so that just arose out of nothing. The Lemon sister, Sarah Ruth, who has autism, came about in part because I wanted to develop more of Lemon's family, and also she's autistic, and in that era, autism just was not very much recognized. And then certainly there are others as well that I wouldn't go into, and the kid who is tormented and bullied, who rehabilitates himself, Melvin Trillip. That actually has an interesting origin, and I'll get into that if we have time to do that.
Yeah, well, get into that a
okay,
little bit.
Okay, all right. Well, I was actually kind of in the finishing stages of many of the chapters, and this was in 2018 when the Parkland shooting took place in Florida. And as a retired teacher, I've always been haunted and tormented by shootings, mass shootings in general, but school shootings in particular really undo me to a great extent, and that took place. And, you know, I had to figure out a way to do some version of that in the context of 1961, which is when that story of Melvin Trillip would occur. And so I took this kid who was bullied, and finally he reaches his end, and he's an expert marksman as a trap shooter, and he comes to school with his gun, and he's going to take care of the bullies. And Jimbo and the other two bring him down, but it's primarily Jimbo who can somehow get that gun away from him. But, you know, 10 years later at Melvin's wedding, he says, "I don't know how you did it, because I really intended to shoot somebody and take myself along with that." And he thanks Jimbo for having done that. And Jimbo, and Mickey says to Jimbo, "Why did you do it? And nobody else could have done it." He said, "Well, you know, if he had shot somebody or himself, Bridgeton would never be the same for us."
Yeah. Yeah. It was very impactful and made me think about some of the same kinds of issues and the same kind of feelings I've had myself over the years as a teacher at the University of Wisconsin here. Mike emailed us. He was guessing Mosinee as the setting. As he read Bridgeton, you described it well, bringing out features, yet left the reader wondering a little bit about actual location. Crafting this the way you did allows the reader to imagine the place the story might be in their own hometown. Mike grew up in Iowa, and the story is related so well to any town in Midwest America.
Ah, nice, thanks. I felt that way, that there was a universality about the town, even though it was very specifically Bridgeton / Mosinee. I think the characters could be any town in America, and what happens are just variations of what happens in any town in America. Obviously, the 1950s and the early 60s were a different time than the current moment, but it was simpler, but not necessarily more innocent.
Let's talk about those characters a little more, the three main characters. I'm not sure that we really zeroed in on how they're different and yet similar.
Well, there are the three, and Mickey is the narrator for all but two of the stories. And he is level-headed. He has a father who is very brusque, but also a deeply caring man. And Mickey kind of takes that on. He's kind of a caretaker personality. One of his two best friends, Lemon, is just super intelligent. He's just like a genius type of a character. Graduates high school early and becomes an orthopedic surgeon. And he marries and lives happily ever after, in one sense, and he's very successful. But as a boy, everybody just knew he was really smart and could figure things out very quickly. Jimbo, the third, is really the tormented one. He was abused by his brother very severely, to the point where he spent a school year staying with Mickey and his family because his father basically couldn't control the older brother who was beating him up, all because of the affair Doc had with Beverly, resulting in the baby Lucy, who dies in the early chapter. And so Mickey is the linchpin between the two. It's perhaps predictable that if Mickey weren't there, Lemon and Jimbo might not even be friends. But it's Mickey who holds the triad together, and he's... He just has a way to bring them together, and you can kind of follow that in some of the stories that he's the one. Even when it's Lemon's sister who is abducted, Sarah Ruth, when she's 10 years old, Mickey is the one who's determined to find Dirty Joe, who then leads the search party to finding her in this cave along the river. And a lot of that goes to Mickey's father. His name is Matt in the story, who, despite his brusqueness as a father, he shows Mickey what it is to be a very caring individual.
Yeah, and at that point, Dirty Joe is a very interesting character because he's looked upon in part of the story as this is a kind of an weird ne'er-do-well who drinks too much to becoming a hero at that particular point.
Right, right. No, he's the hero who finds Sarah Ruth, in part by luck, but he had a hunch that she could be in this cave. And then he comes, and finally it's the inspiration of these boys, kind of. Initially, he's just like one of the boys, in a sense, except he drinks. but he lives in the woods in the summertime and sets up a tent, fishes in the river, and because he can't really integrate back into his hometown. And he's got money. His parents have left him money, and they've assigned Mickey's father to manage the money because they didn't trust Joe to handle it because he would drink the money away. But then in one of my favorite passages of the book, Joe is asked to do a presentation on Veterans Day.
Yeah.
And he's never really talked about what happened to him at Cabanatuan in the Philippines, the death camp, and the prison camp there on the death march. And so he's convinced to go, and he can't do it. He never really talks about it in the whole book, which is very common for a lot of veterans. They go their whole lifetimes unable to talk about their war experiences. And so then Mickey's dad, Matt, steps up and delivers his version of what happened to Joe and how nobody comes back from war the same. And Veterans Day should acknowledge that as much as they acknowledge the glories of war.
It is a beautiful passage, for sure, and so yeah, and by the way, Dirty Joe does appear, even though he's not related. He appears kind of here and there throughout.
Yeah, later in the book, you know, he moves to Daytona to basically get away from Bridgeton and try to be straight, and he does. He's a recovering alcoholic. Does the AA route. And then when Mickey's father dies, he comes up to Bridgeton for the funeral and he can barely handle it. And then some years later, he himself dies, and Mickey adds a chapter where he gives Mickey some gifts, and one of the gifts is the eulogy that he wrote when Mickey's father died but couldn't deliver at the kind of the public memorial service. And so that is, and that stimulates... The boys at that point are in their late 50s, but it stimulates them to ponder their own mortality. And that leads Jimbo to, you know, in the letter, Joe says, I felt very sorry for Jimbo because life did not treat him well, and I was always worried about him. And then they question, Jimbo, is that why you've been so unhappy your whole life? And he goes through, no, things just happen, you know, and I've tried to recover, and I have some depression issues, and I've done my best, but there's nothing to pity me about, just like Joe didn't want any pity either.
Bruce emailed us, loved reading Bridgeton, also remembered watching his teenagers drunk driving that was performed in high schools around Wisconsin back in those days.
Oh, yeah. There was a sense of imperviousness of drinking and driving back in the day, for sure.
Yeah, and it probably still goes on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he viewed, Jimbo viewed Bridgeton quite a bit differently from the other two. And Lemon and Mickey had different, I mean, they all had a little different view of Bridgeton, didn't they?
Yeah, for Mickey, it remains, with its limitations, a very peaceful place. His parents stay there. His father was a local, never left the town except to go to the war and to go to college, came back, had a good job at the paper mill, loses the job, gets another job at another paper mill. His mother is a nurse at the Wausau Hospital. And so it was just kind of this normal hometown. For Lemon, it was as well. But Lemon is just so gifted intellectually that he he views it in a different way. But his sister never left town, and so there's a sense that he's always trying to rescue and save his sister. But for Jimbo, his father came there before Jimbo was born, so he becomes a lifer. But for Jimbo, who's afflicted by depression and just widespread unsuccess in life, it's difficult for him because he feels like he's a failure. But his father, Doc McPherson, really becomes, in the end, even though his father kind of ignored him as a child in many respects, his father becomes then his savior because he teaches him the craft of woodworking. And that becomes Jimbo's gateway into a very happy late-in-life time for himself, and he becomes a real master craftsman selling furniture. And so he can speak about Bridgeton now in a better way, but it's still, there's a bittersweet edge for sure with Jimbo.
Yeah, and I found it interesting that his Jimbo's dad, the Doc, obviously recognized Lemon. He almost treated Lemon like a favored son, and he wasn't a son.
Yeah, right. At one point, Doc hurts himself, and he brings Lemon in to help him deliver services to take notes because he can't use his right hand. And Lemon is like a little bit of a doctor in training, and at one point he says, I didn't have a better teacher than Doc McPherson in all my years of med school and residency.
Michael Knadler, our guest today, his book is titled Bridgeton, and it is our book club book of this part of our season here at Wisconsin Public Radio News. It's great to have him with us. Questions or comments for him? Hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Our book club selection is titled Bridgeton, and we have the author with us today in the studio, Michael Knadler. It's great to have him with us. And we've been having a lot of fun, actually. It's been enjoyable for me to talk with him. And if you have a question or comment or want to join in, I hope you will. Number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Something true to the time period, and I had an experience with it myself, not having polio, but polio. How did polio affect children back in those days?
Well, that was, I don't remember so many specifics, except we were all scared. And so I tried to present that in the story. I wasn't really a friend of hers, but two blocks away there was a girl who did die. And I didn't visit her in the home like I present in the story, where he overcomes his fears and confronts this girl in bed on the brink of going into the hospital to go into the iron lung, and she doesn't survive. But it was just like something in the air. We were all afraid. Everybody would talk about it and was afraid to talk about it at the same time because you didn't know how it could be transmitted. You didn't. It was just like this powerful force. And so I tried to present that in the story, All You Have Is Hope, and because at that point, that's all you felt you could do was hope. Interestingly, at that point in the story, Lemon, who is a real scientific guy who becomes a doctor, goes to the Catholic school, and they pray to not get polio, and they ask God, don't bring polio to us. And at the end, when this girl dies from polio, he becomes very disillusioned. As a 10, 11-year-old, you'd think, well, that's way beyond his thinking at a 10, but he's just a really bright guy, and that becomes his... He said, I don't want to go to the Catholic school anymore. I want to go to the public school because praying did not do anything to solve this problem. I'm going to be a scientist, and those are the people who actually solved it.
Yeah, very affecting. There were some really joyful parts in ways that I smiled about, and you tell it so well. There's, I think it might have been the, you have three sort of segments.
Right.
There's the, you know, their young period, and then the middle period is sort of like high school, and then the third period is they're in their 40s, starting at that point, mm-hmm. roughly. But the in the first segment, the first section of the book, I think it's the last chapter when you talk about 6 feet of snow.
Yeah.
That was, there were some serious things in there and some excitement, but also a lot of joy. And it reminded me of.
Yeah, it was very much a tribute to the phenomenon of a cold, snowy winter, which I remember there being a lot of snow. I mean, it's so different now where there's much, much less snow. But and they are. It's an extraordinary snowfall, and everybody's off of school, and he's part of a group of what are called the junior snowboys. They just go shovel out the driveways and the porches of the people who can't get out and do it themselves. But it's a joyful thing, and it ends with this tribute of they're exhausted after a long day of shoveling and helping Doc get into this home and treat this woman who might be dead, and they have to shovel their way into her home as he makes a house call. And I remember many house calls with my father mm-hmm. back in the day, and so it was a little bit of a tribute to that phenomenon. But in the end, Doc says, if you still got energy, go out and just walk around in the moonlight and look at all this snow. And they do, and they see these houses that look no bigger than dog houses under the snow, and they go down to the skating rink, which is the community gathering point in the winter, and it's being shoveled and plowed, and they skate for several hours, and they stand there as the Chet Parker, who runs the skating rink, plays the finale of Auld Lang Syne, and they hold. And on the way, back home, they just are so exhausted they slip and fall in the snow, and they just start laughing because there's never been a day like it.
Yeah, I love that story, and I frankly remember the skating rink at Cottage Grove, Wisconsin, where guys would bring out the shovels and push the snow away.
Yeah, for sure.
And I could skate with some skates that were too big for me, so my ankles would wobble and everything else, but I enjoyed it a lot. Chuck in Dodgeville has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. I just wanted to say that in today's world, public education gets frequently criticized by many people, and I just wanted to say I had the good fortune of teaching across the hall in Dodgeville High School uh-huh. from Mike Knadler, and what an excellent teacher he was, and I think it's very apparent by his comments about the book. Bridgeton, you know how good he was, and I know my kids had him as a teacher, and they had so many good things to say about him. So I just wanted to thank him for that.
Thanks, Chuck.
That's have you gotten a lot of? I mean, the book's been out a while now.
I mean,
what kinds of experiences have you had with readers and just people that you've come in contact with as a teacher?
Well, I mean. A number of friends and relatives have read it, and whether they actually liked it or not, they're very nice to me when they give me their reviews. I think many of them actually did like it a lot. But some of the most heartwarming are people I've never met who picked it off a library shelf and read it and said, wow, I couldn't put it down sort of a thing. And so I feel that it accomplished what I was trying to accomplish. And you know, one of the characters in the book related to Chuck's call becomes a teacher, and he tries to, you know, carry on kind of the messages that I had as an adult, where you try to transmit knowledge and experience and a certain amount of wisdom to the kids who sit before you year after year, in my case, 30 years of it. And so teaching is a very undervalued profession, and so I wanted to honor that to some extent in the book.
It's always a pleasure for me to get sometimes a letter, other times nowadays more likely an email from mm-hmm. from a student I might have had even 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, it happens not so much anymore because I've been out of the game for a while, but I know I had a job for a while in Dodgeville at Land's End where I was the meter and greeter of people at the Land's End Activity Center, and my job was to screen people who were coming in so they wouldn't sneak in or or just to answer phones. And students would come in who I had as students, and they'd be with their wives and children, and we'd end up having a conversation, and I would say something to the effect, you know, with all due respect, you were really a knucklehead in high school. And it really gives me lots of pride to see you, you know, such a responsible guy. And they would laugh, and they say, yeah, I really was a knucklehead.
Oh, my goodness. What makes an experience, good or bad, stick with us throughout our life?
Yeah, no, it's a big question. And while most of these experiences I'm manufacturing from my imagination, the spirit of being affected by something for a life is really, it's a wonderful question. I mean, is it those big moments that predictably people would say, well, of course that would affect you. Somebody really important dying when you're young, or somebody you meet who just kind of transforms you. But remarkably, it's often the little things that you don't even think about as being life changing that become those big moments. And it's different for everybody, and that's the beauty of reflecting back on our lives, because if you were to draw a timeline of your life and highlight it with those big moments, people would probably be very surprised at what you put in that timeline.
Yeah, I was thinking back to, as you were talking, I was thought back to a few times in high school, comments that somebody made offhand that just kind of stuck with me, it feels like I can recall those scenes, and they're just sort of minor, off the cuff comments that actually had. Here I am, all these years later, I can still recall the situation and what was said at the time.
It happened. I had to be, you know, all teachers are aware of what you say and what you don't say, because you never know what's going to linger on with a student later. But on more than one occasion, I would see a former student, and he would say, you know, when you told me at the end of the course that I finally got it in my final paper that I wrote for you, I felt so happy. And I was, you know, saying, well, what about the rest of the semester when you didn't get it? But as he said, it just took me a long time to figure it out.
Yeah.
So you never know what that comment will be that will trigger some great memories.
So what's next for you? Are you going to, somebody, other person emailed and said, are you going to do a sequel? I don't know how you'd sequel that one. But
well, it would have to be much different. It would be, I mean, these guys are alive. Some of the people who were important are no longer alive. But it's a possible. I mean, I think the phenomenon of what happens to people like me or anybody else of my vintage, what happens to us as we get old and try to figure out a great way to live out the rest of our lives is pretty important. And so just tracing them for a few more years would be interesting.
I think it'd be fun. Michael, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Boy, it flew by.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Larry. And thank to all the listeners and
lots
people
of
who wrote notes.
Yeah, I'm sorry we didn't get to all the comments, but that's the way it goes sometimes. Michael Knaedler, our guest, and his book, take a look at it. It's titled Bridgeton, set right here in Wisconsin. And, of course, Michael is right here in Wisconsin himself. So it was great reading it and great having him with us today. And coming up, we're going to switch gears here and talk about some efforts for growing flax and weaving linen right here in Wisconsin. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we are turning our attention to really a cool topic, I think. Flax. You know anything about flax? We can grow flax really well here in Wisconsin, I think. And you know what flax, what linen turns into? Well, it's flax can turn into linen. Let's put it that way. And we're going to talk about growing flax and producing linen with a couple of guests. One of them, Jessica Becker, in the studio with us. She's the Interim Director of Communications for the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters. And, important for this show, she manages the outreach and communications for Midwest Linen Revival. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you with us. And also with us is Leslie Schrader. She is the founder of Midwest Linen Revival. And yeah, Leslie, you got a big job too. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Larry. And I want to say happy Juneteenth to you and all of your listeners.
As well. Thank you very much. Let us know as we talk with our two guests, what you'd like to see in terms of, this is a textile we're talking about here, textile production in Wisconsin. How much do you think about maybe where your clothes come from or who makes them or who makes your bed sheets? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jessica, what's the Midwest Linen Revival?
Well, thanks for asking. We are working together. Leslie founded Midwest Linen Revival, yeah. And we're working together right now to produce Field to Frock, which is a series of events to bring people into the conversation about, yeah, what is happening in the Midwest with linen and textiles. The revival word is actually interesting because it's bringing back our connection with our textiles and reviving that agricultural possibility for growing fiber that can be used for clothing here in the Midwest.
You know, that goes, the whole concept of linen itself goes way, way back. Doesn't it?
Right. Tens of thousands of years, actually, people have been growing this plant and using the fiber for it. And as you said in your introduction, you know, flax becomes linen. People right now are more familiar with flax as the seed, which is also super good for you. Yeah. And it's the same plant. But here we're talking about a different strain for the stem and where the fiber is coming from.
So you can't get a good seed out of the... You need a certain type of flax to make really good linen.
Yeah, everybody wants to know about dual crop opportunities. And, you know, it could do both, but neither well. So you can have, you know, your oilseed varieties that are creating a lot of stem and use that. The oilseed varieties creating a lot of heavy seed set. And mm-hmm. From that, you can, of course, eat it. You can press it for oil. There's all kinds of other product opportunities there. But the stem of those oilseed varieties are shorter. And then when they're harvested that later, they're a little stiffer. So there's secondary textile opportunities there. But when we're talking about garments, then it is a different strain of the same flax plant, but with a longer stem and harvested earlier.
Okay, makes sense. Mary Kay in Kenosha with us has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I'd like to talk about textiles. We need to grow cotton because cotton is the most comfortable fabric. We can use wool, paper. I got a beautiful hat made out of paper. You'd never know it. It looks like lace. Hemp, reeds for shoes. We can have recycling recycleries where you can recycle old clothes and turn them into other fabrics like clothing, shoes.
Yeah, that was, well, so,
Mary Kay,
go ahead, Leslie.
You got a pretty good list there, but you did not have flax on your list. And that is a plant that grows really well in Wisconsin's climate. When you said we need to be growing cotton, so we cannot grow cotton in the northern parts of the state. So I do know somebody who grew some cotton in a greenhouse. But right now, it's actually a better crop for southern United States. I mean, we can wait for our climate change future and maybe be growing cotton here. But right now, let's not hope for that. Flax is actually really well suited for the Midwest.
And linen itself, I mean, I guess linen doesn't have to take a back seat to cotton. I mean, linen has some advantage. I mean, there are probably advantages and disadvantages. Might as well talk about those.
Sure. Actually, cotton requires a lot more inputs and pesticides and support from the processing of it, uses a lot of water. So the flax plant is also, you know, there's a fair number of steps and it's labor intensive to process. But the ultimate product in a linen garment is incredibly durable. So it's something that can actually service you for a really long time and soften with age.
And isn't it a fabric or a textile that, you know, we're going to have tomorrow or so, we're going to have some pretty warm temperatures here. And my recollection is that linen was very good for wearing in hot and humid conditions.
That's exactly right. It's a temperature moderating type of fabric. People have often used it historically as an underlayer to their scratchy wool garments. So it's actually the word linen cognate with the word lining and lingerie. So as an undergarment was people used a lot, but also as, you think of those, hot summer days, linen can serve you really well.
Let's talk about what does a flax plant look like? Somebody wants to know that already. Does it look like a oats or does it? Do you want to talk about that, Jessica?
Absolutely. It's a beautiful plant. In fact, I was just looking at some growing in a pot in Leslie's backyard. And so it's a tall green stem that grows really densely together, which is part of the advantage in that you don't need a lot of pesticides because it grows really densely together.
And keeps the weeds out by itself.
Yeah. And has a beautiful flower. So some people are starting to grow it for bouquets even. It has a really pretty kind of cornflower blue flower. And it doesn't need to be pollinated by bees, but it does attract pollinators.
So that's pretty cool. I do like the flower, too. That's a pretty blue flower. Grace in New Glarus has something. Let's go there. Hi, Grace.
Hi. Glad to hear this topic, and I wish I could participate in all of the events this weekend. It would be tons of fun. Another fiber, and one that is native to North America, is milkweed. Milkweed has absolutely amazing fibers. California Indians used milkweed to make nets up to something like 3 miles long for catching rabbits. And some of the remains of some of those nets are in museums, and they are literally hundreds of years old. And they're still, if they're not exposed to the elements, they stay strong for a very, 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 very long time.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Grace. So milkweed and also dogbane and even the linden tree and the nettles are all bast fibers, just like flax and just like hemp, which means all of them, the fiber is coming from the stem of the plant. And one of them, the stinging nettle, is also, tasty edible. But we're having the film, the nettle dress, which is one of the elements of our Field to Frock festival. And that's somebody that spent years, it's a documentary, harvesting the nettle plant and then hand processing it and spinning it, weaving it, and makes a garment.
Maybe we need a little more information about the events itself, and we'll get to that in just a minute. Leslie Schrader and Jessica Becker, our guests today. Jessica is the outreach and communications person for Midwest Linen Revival, and Leslie is the founder of Midwest Linen Revival. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at linen today on the show, growing flax and weaving linen in Wisconsin. There's some efforts by some people, and especially Leslie Schrader and Jessica Becker, to get this going a bit here in our state and in the Midwest in general. Leslie's the founder of Midwest Linen Revival, and Jessica manages outreach and communications for Midwest Linen Revival. And again, you can join in too. Number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. The reason for this revival, I think, in some way, is to kind of develop stronger interest among farmers, I suppose, in part.
Yeah, if I could for a moment, Larry, talk tell you a sad story about the current state of our textile industry, which is very heavily environmentally consumptive. And it's mostly because of the synthetics in our garments. So it's very extractive petroleum-based products. It's our polyesters and our nylons. And then as we're wearing them, little bits of microplastics are breaking off into our water as we're laundering them. So 30% of microplastics in water right now are coming from our clothes. And then, of course, end game, that synthetic garment just sits in a landfill. We see really ugly pictures of them like washing up in the oceans, right? So we have this really big problem from, you know, the whole life cycle of our current garments. So it's not just about, you know, the flax being an amazing opportunity for diversifying our agricultural economy with a relatively easily sustainably grown crop that works well in a lot of different small grain rotations. It's because we have such a big problem with our current textile industry. And then what we're talking about when we talk about like slow clothes and bringing that home to, you know, the more hand spun, really textile experiences is just, it's a touch point. It's a connection point for starting to think about our garments and who grew your clothes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about, I don't want to leave without talking about this event in more, these events in more detail, Jessica. So fill us in on what people are going to be able to see and so forth.
All right. Well, starting tomorrow, for those of us in the Madison area, we have a series that we hope kind of offers a bunch of ways to enter into this conversation. And so, you know, whether you're a maker, a DIY person, an artist, a textile enthusiast, or an agriculturist, a small farmer, or a local foodie, or a fashionista, someone who just is interested in building community. We have a series of events that starts tomorrow on campus, actually, at the Allen Centennial Gardens, the opportunity to see natural dyeing and plants that they've been growing there and how that's done. And then we have a special behind-the-scenes textile tour in the Helen Louise Allen Collection on campus. There's two tours. And then on Saturday, we have a really wonderful chance to get out into the field and see this flax growing. And we'll have someone there from the Low-Tech Institute, as well as Leslie and others, tabling with a lot of information and demonstrating how the small-scale processing can happen if you were to grow some flax in your own backyard and you wanted to spin it. So that processing will be demonstrated. But it's also just a fun way to get out in the field.
Can I throw in a couple other folks that are present there? Is also tabling is partners like the Textile Arts Center and Fibershed Heartland and folks from the UW Extension and Madison Weavers Guild. So there's a lot of good conversations that are going to be happening that Saturday morning.
That's from 10 to 2, and it's at Troy Gardens. And all of these events are free, I should mention. And we then, in the afternoon on Saturday, have two back-to-back events in the Aubergine space across from Willie Street Co-op on Williamson Street. And those are really the chance to see some really expert spinners use flax, and even you can try it. We've got three spinners coming, and then we've got a mending workshop. Leslie, what are the names of the spinners? You want to do a shout-out to those?
Yeah, so we've got B from Babe's Fiber Garden. We've got Evie from Jillian Evie. She's put out a lot of YouTube videos in the how-to world of handmade textiles. And then we have Emily with the Madison Weavers Guild, all super deeply knowledgeable spinners there to show us that magical moment of when it goes from flax to linen.
And the website, what's the website that people can go to just to learn more on?
Yeah, so you can learn a lot more about all of this stuff at MidwestLinenRevival.org, and you'll find the full schedule for Field to Frock. And I'll just mention the last two things on Sunday. We've got a happy hour fashion show at the High Noon Saloon. This is a free event. Mm-hmm. Doors open at 4, and we want to show off how fabulous linen looks on all sorts of people and bodies, all ages. And we've got a great collection of vintage and new linen from some of the shops around town. So I'll mention Still Goods and the Good Style Shop, as well as the maker, Emily Pop, who makes clothing from old linen textiles. And then the final event we've already mentioned is the Nettle Dress. It's a documentary, and it's screening at the Art and Lit Lab at 7 p.m. So we've had some amazing partnerships to make this possible, and we have funding from Dane Arts, from the Willie Street Co-op, and from Wisconsin Farmers Union that we're really grateful for.
Yeah, Midwest Linen Revival. And Maya in Clintonville has a comment, I think, that relates to all this. Let's go there. Hi, Maya.
Hi, my name is Maya. I was just calling in because I think it is so amazing to hear people locally talking about having resources like clothing that are actually from somewhere that you know of. I know that I have young children, and when I go to the store and I buy things, I always look at, like, where was this made? It's always in other countries, but I do really love it when I go to a local shop and I buy something that says this was made in the U.S. But to have something made, like, locally in Wisconsin is even more amazing. It's just really great to see all of these people realizing how valuable it is for us to get things locally. And it does contribute so much to our communities when organizations work together to make that happen.
Yeah. Maya, thank you so much for calling. Leslie, a comment?
Yeah, Maya, thank you for your enthusiasm. And that's what we need, people looking at the labels of their clothes and thinking about them. And yeah, that it's something that's an element of our regional economy and agriculture.
And you've been working, Leslie, with farmers in southern Wisconsin to help them to grow flax. Tell us more about that part of your work.
Right. So right now we're growing at a really small artisanal hand scale because we do not have the processing equipment that could handle it at a larger scale. So there's all kinds of elements that need to be brought up almost simultaneously. And that is seed supply, and that is farmer knowledge, and also that processing equipment. So every one of those we're scooting forward a little bit at a time.
Yeah, it sounds like it could be a chicken and egg sort of thing.
Maya's comment reminds me of that because, of course, we need people saying, hey, we want this, in order for there to be the interest in growing the flax and in building the infrastructure. And so it's important to have all those things moving forward. People paying attention, as they have started to so much recently with the local foods movement, paying attention to where your food comes from and where your clothes come from.
Yeah. Jeff and Barry Mills couldn't stay with us, wondering if you've heard of using linen cloth to store vegetables.
I don't see why not. That would be really interesting to learn more if there's something about just the breathability or.
Yeah. I don't know either. That's what we could think about or look into. Jeff probably may have some knowledge of that. Grant emailed. He's an avid bread baker, uses flaxseed couche to help bread dough in a chosen shape as the dough ferments. Is there a best way to take care for a couche?
I don't know about that, but I do want to say that flaxseed is really good for you. So that plant is offering us a lot. Yeah,
I think that's a good way to put it. Well, how much would we need to get a plant of some sort that could develop?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that one thing is siting some of the processing facilities on a rail line so that it can be pulling from, you know, a larger region. There is equipment that when I toured Normandy in France, where most of the world's linen is coming from, their big giant scutching facilities are by this manufacturer, Deporte. And they're kind of like the single one that you want to that processing facility is the gold standard.
A gold standard.
Right. There's other smaller scale ones that people are working on, and that is what I'm interested in right now, is just sort of doing more proof of concept, stepping into it. And so I am looking to connect with folks who are interested in that kind of like tinkering level as we work our way into scaling up.
Laura in Manitowoc has something that may relate to what you were just talking about. Laura, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to be one of the voices that calls in and says, first of all, I want this. I'm not going to make any of the events this weekend. So what's the best way for me to really, you know, learn about this? And I mean, obviously, I can go to the website, but if I want to connect with people that are doing this and learn about weaving and learn about how to get the flax to weave and all of that, what's the best way to do that after this weekend, after this event?
Yeah, so there's two organizations that I'd like to direct you to. One is called Fibershed, and they have many regional affiliates. So I know that there's one in your area that you can connect with, and they're doing things like you know, processing demonstrations, and they're doing, you know, all of the wonderful meetups and the learnings around textiles that I think you're going to be interested in. It's called FiberShed. So there's FiberShed affiliates literally around the world now. And then the other one is the North American Linen Association. And that is, you know, the group of us who are all in this smitten with linen. I think I'm member number two in the North American Linen Association. Now they're something up over 100. So this is, you know, a number of folks all thinking the same way. And there's a lot of energy being built around it now.
And how would you contact that group?
Online. Yeah. So North American Linen Association and FiberShed. Those are two different organizations.
Those are the two. Okay, Laura, there you go. Thank you. Sullivan in Green Bay, your turn. Hi.
Hi. So, one question. Have you and your guests reached out to any reenactment groups and how they have been using linen or if they've been growing linen or flax?
Yep. Actually, the very first time that I ever saw flax being processed was at Old World, Wisconsin, which is over in Waukesha County. And there is... there's a couple of other organizations. I said Low Tech Institute, they've been growing flax. And there are other, exactly what you're saying, reenactment groups. There was a group in UW Green Bay that has done some exploration because I think they were going to try to build a Viking sailcloth. But yeah, thank you. Absolutely. That is, I think of them as torchbearers. I think it's an incredibly important thing that just sort of laid low for a long time, that people didn't lose that knowledge entirely.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And there's a whole process to this. I mean, this whole turning flax into linen. I mean, you've got your harvest, you got redding, you got drying.
Mm-hmm. Actually, what you do is you hire this guy named Rumpelstiltskin, and he's the one that makes that flax into gold. I don't know. Yeah, you harvest it by pulling the plant up, and the first step is this wonderful word retting, which is a slight decomposition of the plant, where the stiff inner part that's called the shive is starting to get separated from the fibers. So that's called retting, and that's one of the most important pieces to assess, to like carefully learn about, because if it doesn't go far enough, it won't process well. If it goes too far, it just damages the fiber. And then all sorts of other wonderful words. It goes through the ripple, it goes through the break, the scutch, and the hackle. And each one of those are steps of cleaning the fiber. And once you've got clean fiber, it's called a sliver. And then the sliver is spun on a distaff.
And it's a pretty cool words. It's a pretty cool process. And actually, we Wisconsin Life did a nice little piece that anybody can go to our Wisconsin Life and get some photos of you know, and so forth, a description of it.
Yeah, that was really wonderful. Maureen actually tried her hand at it.
Maureen McAllis does a really good job of that.
She was there using all the old tools and, learning the process firsthand. It was pretty fun.
Listener emailed us with a note that there's an event planned for August 2nd in Athens, Wisconsin, to highlight linen grieving and harvesting. It will be at the Red Door Family Farm from 10 to 2.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. And I'll be there.
It's hosted by Northern Pines Fiber Shed and Marathon County Farmers Union.
Wonderful. Yep, that is one of the fiber sheds that is, as I mentioned earlier.
Where can you buy locally made textiles and clothing?
So right now we have a fairly small but functioning woolen economy. That I would follow up with some of the wool mills around here, like Utopia and Brown Barn and Blackberry Ridge. Those are places that you can buy yarn. The Madison Weavers Guild, sometimes their members are, that's another source that I would connect with for people that are doing handmade textiles. Another is the Driftless Tannery. They're doing hair on sheep hides and coming up with some really wonderful products.
So have you ever made any yourself?
I've made lots of things by hand, but never 100% from my own linen. I've actually not yet. Not yet.
And you gave me a strand here.
Mostly I wanted to impress you with the fact that fiber is really long. That's what makes it really unique. So I've handed Larry a little bit of a cleaned flax fiber that I grew. And so will you tell us about it?
It feels like horsehair.
It's a little bit, yeah, it hasn't been quite softened enough, but it's golden, you know. It's like where the name of flaxen-haired girl comes from is that color. Mm-hmm.
Well, and here we are out of time, which it really flew, didn't it? We'll have to have you back and talk some more. I'd love to hear your progress on this.
Well, thank you.
Over time. I think it's going to be fun to follow, and let's hope we get a vibrant industry going here in the state.
Yeah, we guarantee it. It feels like the right place, right time.
Leslie Schrader is the founder of Midwest Linen Revival. Jessica Becker is the interim director of communication for the Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters, and manages outreach and communication for Midwest Linen Revival. Well, it's great to have them with us. And next up, we revisit a conversation we had about clean, allergy-friendly design. And we'll hear from our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, heading that up next. And that's and it's pre-recorded. I'll mention that as well. Thank you for listening. And stay with us.
This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and today we're talking about getting rid of allergens in your home so you and your loved ones can breathe easier. With us today is Robin Wilson. She owns a nationally recognized eco-friendly lifestyle brand and she is an interior designer. She has 20 years of experience advocating for clean construction and design methods through her firm, Robin Wilson Home. She's also the author of two really nice books on the subject. Do you think your allergies or asthma is caused by your home or the things in it? What would you like to know about how to breathe easier when you're there? Well, we'd like you to be part of the conversation, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Robin, welcome back.
How are you doing?
I am doing really, really well. How about yourself?
Very good. It's so cold here as we approach spring. I hope everyone is thinking about things they can do now for a wonderful, non-wheezing and sneezing spring.
Absolutely. And we're just getting over a very, very cold spell. And today it might get 50 down in the southern part of the state. It's, you know, like spring here. So.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. It's been a crazy year. So before we start getting into the nitty-gritty here, why don't you give us a definition of clean design?
Well, I believe that everyone has the propensity to wheeze and sneeze if their house is not clean.
Right.
And also if the building materials in their home is not clean. And so what we try to do is guide people from the foundation to the furnishings on simple things that they can do to make sure that their home is a healthy space for their family.
So what are some of the advantages of this type of design that people may not always recognize?
Well, the simple tip is recognizing that walls are actually the biggest surface in your house. Most people would say floors, but walls are the biggest surface. So what paint are you putting on your walls? It should be no VOC, which means that it's not off-gassing. And also, you should be dusting those walls every once in a while. And that's a simple thing to do to keep your home clean.
Yeah, I'm really bad at that, Robin. I don't think about it. You know, we don't think there's dust, though, right? Especially if you've got textured walls. Oh, my gosh, I'm bad. I'm going to have to go home and do that right away.
Well, I also tell people that we spend one-third of our life sleeping.
Yes.
And we actually have something we call the rule of threes. And mm-hmm. the rule of threes is to ask someone first, when was the last time you washed or replaced your pillow? And most people start to grimace because they realize it's been 6 years, sometimes even longer.
Ouch.
I know. And so when we tell people that, we also then remind them that a simple pillow test is try to fold your pillow in half. If it bounces back, you're in good shape. If it stays in place, it probably weighs more now than when you bought it.
Ew. Okay, thank you. Let's not go into details, but why?
Exactly. So then we go to the rule of threes, and this is a simple clean design home tip. Every 3 weeks, you should wash the zippered pillowcase. that's over your pillow.
Mm-hmm.
Every month, you or 3 months, you should wash the actual pillow if it's a down alternative pillow. If it's a feather pillow, you might take it outside and I guess they shake it or something of that nature. Although I do recommend down alternative pillows. And then on an every 3 year basis, if you haven't done all those things, you should replace your pillow.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll have you know that I just washed mine like 2 weeks ago. I feel so proud of myself. It's like I flossed when I went to the dentist, right? It's the same thing.
That's right. That's right. So if you think about clean design, it's wellness for your lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It's simple things that you can do to improve your life and your family's life without spending a lot of money. And especially as we go into the spring season, sometimes people don't realize that they need to also check around their home on in every room, even the unused rooms, was there any water penetration into their space? And if there was, find out where it's coming from. Is it from the roof? Is it from the gutters being clogged? Those are some simple things you could do right now as everything is thawing out.
And because that moisture can create mold, right?
That's correct. And mold is something that can then trigger allergens or asthma conditions, mm-hmm. which become chronic conditions for your life.
Yes, for sure. Well, we've got a call from Angela in Partyville. Go ahead, Angela. What question do you have?
Hi, I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
We moved into a new home in 2019, and the previous owners had four pets. And I used to have chronic sore throat, nasal congestion in the fall and the spring. But after we moved in, I started having it year round. And I finally got my ducts cleaned, and that resolved it. I no longer had the issues. My question is, I'm noticing lately that the toilet paper that we use, and I've tried three different brands, so that creates like this little dust. And is there anything that you recommend about that or a type of toilet paper?
Yes, I've noticed that, my too, Angela. It's annoying.
Well, I wish I could go to the toilet paper manufacturers and tell them to stop doing whatever they're doing, but yeah. I have noticed it too. So the only thing that I tell people now is use a microfiber cloth, or I don't want to advocate for any particular brand, but do a quick dust up every day in your bathroom area where that dust does fly around.
Yeah, and think about, you know, it's not really popular in the United States, but it's getting there. Think about a bidet, Angela. Less waste with paper and dust. So
exactly.
Yeah,
but some bathrooms, if they don't have the space for a bidet,
mm-hmm.
there is, and especially if you're in Wisconsin, Kohler is an amazing company. They actually have a new toilet seat version, and you can retrofit your toilet. You'll have to have a plug back there. But you can retrofit your toilet seat to become a bidet seat.
Yeah, I have a friend who just put one in, and he loves it, and it wasn't too bad to fit it in. So something to look into for sure. So when it comes to the things in our house, what are some of the areas that can easily be made, you know, like eco-friendly?
Well, the first place to think about is, it's funny, your bathroom. you know, since we're on that subject, I love Kohler products. I recommend them because they have something called water sense, and that means that it's minimal water usage, that they have filtration systems to actually manage the flow from your shower. And of course, they have toilets that have two buttons or two settings, one for a larger flush and one for a smaller flush. The other thing that I think is critically important in an eco-conscious or eco-friendly bathroom is making sure that the backer board, and that's something most people don't think about unless they fully renovate a bathroom, that the backer board will prevent mold growth. And if you have wallpaper in your bathroom, take it down today.
Okay, why?
when you take it down, you will likely see mold growing behind it.
I see what you're saying. I actually just changed out the wallpaper in my bathroom, and it was fine. So I guess we're okay, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay. Well,
the other thing, and you know, of course, you know, clean design home is sold at major retailers. We actually have a towel line that we have sold, and it's sold at Macy's and Belk and Wayfair and HSN. And this, our towels are made of what they call long strand cotton.
Ah.
And that means that it doesn't lint as much as some of the lesser towels.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, just like your caller said, lint attracts dust. Dust attracts, dust mites.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, then you have the allergic and allergy triggers. So I do recommend a long strand cotton towel. And Clean Design Home is one to consider.
Okay. Now, we're talking about healthy air and breathing today on the show. And one way, you know, you can help your house is air with an air purifier, right?
Well, true, but most people forget to change the filter.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You think it's like plug it in and go. But it doesn't work if it's not.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
So please, if you do get an air purifier, change the filter on a seasonal basis, if not more frequently. And then also consider plants. Most people, if you Google right now, you'll find that Dracaena plants
mm-hmm.
and corn cane plants are some of the highest ranked plants for actually removing formaldehyde and chemicals from the air.
Right. There's a number of plants that I think, was it NASA that did the testing not too long ago? There's a whole list out there that will help you with that.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. A Dracaena plant will filter 90% of toxins in a 100 square foot space.
That is incredible. And they're not that expensive, so can't hurt, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, tell us about the air purifiers themselves. What types are available?
There's so many, and I don't like to advocate for a particular brand.
Okay.
But I will say this. I have one at my home that indicates if there's a toxin in the air, and it glows a different color.
Wow.
And then it automatically increases its power. To, like, if you bring a candle, a scented candle into the room, within a minute, it will detect that emission and will rev its engine up and start to try to remove that toxin from the air.
Mm-hmm.
I don't spend the $9. Be prepared to spend more money
okay.
than $9. If someone says it's $9, it's not a real air purifier.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure it has a HEPA filter.
Okay.
Make sure that you're able to change it and clean it. And also make sure you have a HEPA filter vacuum. Because otherwise you'll vacuum, and you remember probably at your grandmother's house, you'd vacuum and you'd see the dust clouds flying behind the vacuum.
Oh, yes.
You don't want that to happen.
No.
It's just defeating.
Mm-hmm. And there's filters in there that have to be cleaned too, right, in your vacuum cleaner?
In the vacuum cleaner, there are filters as well as your air purifier. And so, again, I do it on a seasonal basis. I clean the actual interior of the air filter
mm-hmm.
System on my vacuum and also on the air purifier. So there's a day when things are laying out on the countertop or in the mudroom.
Right. I've done that. Yeah, you have to make sure it dries out. So,
That's right.
Yeah, for sure. So where's the best place to put an air purifier in your home? I've always wondered about that.
I actually suggest putting it in places where you congregate frequently. That can be a bedroom, a living room. And, of course, if you have children, a nursery or play space.
Okay. And some of them can be, they're kind of, you know, unattractive.
Mm-hmm.
Have you come up with ways to make them look better?
I actually found that having it out, given what I do, is a great conversation starter.
That's
so
true.
So I actually leave mine out. It also reminds me to clean it.
Oh, yeah, that's a very good point, because otherwise you kind of forget about it until maybe your allergies start kicking in.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, another thing that we also forget about are our heater filters or HVAC system filters.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have a monoflow system where water runs through pipes within the wall. I suggest that every couple of years you change that water. During the off season, it's just sitting there. potential mold growth could occur. Mm-hmm. And so when you turn it on, potentially you're letting those spores, remember mold is spores, and as it circulates, maybe you could affect yourself in the first couple of days of turning on your heat. But if you have a regular HVAC system that blows air, I would suggest, even though they say change it every season or maybe every 6 weeks, I would say change your filter on a monthly basis.
Okay. Now, what about those ducts that, you know, our caller earlier had mentioned she had those cleaned? Do you agree with her that they should be cleaned periodically?
I do, but I also say that sometimes cleaning your ducts, it's not going to help. Mm-hmm. It depends on the system. Do you have a what they call a, I don't want to call it plastic, but do you have a metal or stainless steel piping system? Do you have a PVC piping system? Do you have a corrugated metal piping system? It depends on what's going on in your HVAC system. And ducts can sometimes look very dirty at the surface, but there's stuff deep, deep in there. So make sure that they're using an extension vacuum and not just at the surface.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, like I said, today is nice here. And maybe some people are going to think about opening their windows. Is that good or bad for people who maybe are suffering from allergies or what have you?
I think that everyone, if it's not too cold, if you can open your windows for between 1 and 5 minutes, at least one window in the house, 1 to 5 minutes a day, and let some fresh air in, you're doing a service to yourself.
Oh, great.
A lot of homes today are hermetically sealed, meaning we seal them as much as we can from outside, whereas older homes, they were breathing a little bit, to be polite. If you think about the oven cleaner, the bathroom cleaner, the air freshener type things, and scented candles and any other number of chemicals we place in our home, if we don't let it air out every day, every week, we potentially are creating a chemical overload in our homes.
That makes total sense. We do have a call. Dale and Baldwin, go right ahead with your question.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Proud new grandparents and admire how protective our daughter is of our 19-month-old grandbaby. The question is with bath toys, the ones that you can squeeze in and out. Of course, she loves to squeeze get bubbles and then squeeze the water back up. But we notice that there are often pieces of mold, you know, when we do that. So wondering about concern for that, how best to clean those toys.
Great question, Dale. What do you think, Robin?
That's the best question ever. I have I remember when my daughter was young, I went to a seminar about wellness for children's toys. And the physicians there said, throw them all out. I said, oh my gosh, I have these great squeaky toys that are distracting in the bath. And they said, throw them all out. But before you do, cut them open and see what's inside. After cutting open two of them, I threw them all out.
Oh, dear.
So the first thing to tell you is those are really cute little toys, but they have openings inside which allow them to float and make that squeaky noise. And unless you are extremely rigorous about cleaning them every single day or every single time they're wet, they will begin to harbor bacteria and mold.
Okay, Dale, congratulations on being a grandparent, but yeah, you're going to break your little kid's heart by throwing them away.
Yes. Get the rubber duck that doesn't have a hole in it. How
there you
that?
Go. Yeah. Yeah. Forget about the squeakiness. Leave those for the dogs. Thanks for the call, Dale. Deb emailed us, and she wanted you to spell the name of the plant that you mentioned earlier as the number one best cleaning for indoor air. It's Dracaena.
Sure.
Dracaena, right?
Yes, it's Dracaena. NA. Mm-hmm. And also the corn cane plant does formaldehyde removal.
Mm-hmm. Both very readily available pretty much anywhere. So very easy to find. So thanks for that question, Deb. Vivian emailed, we were talking earlier about the toilet paper dust. She says you can keep your toilet paper off its hanger and just unroll it by hand, and that seems to create less dust.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a it drives me crazy when it's not on the roll, but yeah, that's a good idea.
The only problem with that, I tell her, is going back to Dale having a 19-month-old, you do that and you might end up with a toilet paper party in the bathroom.
Or a pet, too. Yeah, yeah. You know, going back, we had mentioned candles a couple times. Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard things in the past about candles not being the greatest thing to be lighting in your home, and scented candles in particular. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I do believe that you should buy what I call a higher quality candle. The reason for that is they will typically have a cotton wick. They will not have any type of metals or otherwise within that wick, or that they will have a soy-based wax with a blend so it doesn't smoke as much. And also, they will not use hugely synthetic fragrances. They'll use essential oils instead.
Okay.
You do not want a petroleum-based candle in your home. You want beeswax or soy wax, and I recommend soy wax mix. The other thing is, when you trim the wick, make it very short, you will have less smoke typically.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a very long wick.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for that. Before we let you go, you've got a big announcement to share with us about your business. What's new here?
Well, please tune in to HSN on February the 7th at 2 p.m. and also on the 8th at 10 a.m. I will be on HSN, and we will be doing some things for the top of bed. And pillows.
Oh, nice. Now, that's the Home Shopping Network, for those of you who aren't familiar with HSN.
Home Shopping Network.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's a one-hour segment, and you can also go onto their website right now and type in Clean Design Home by Robin Wilson, or just my name.
Okay.
And buy a few things right now.
Wonderful. And for people who have, you know, allergy problems with them or their family, it's really nice to know that you understand, right?
I grew up a pan-allergic child, which means food, pet dander, smoke, dust, almost like the bubble child, right? And my mom thankfully we had a regular pediatrician, but there's a holistic pediatrician that she went to. I guess euphemistically you would call it a hippie doctor. But I almost say it's like the Patch Adams. He wore a Hawaiian shirt. He had a ponytail. But this particular doctor said, you can raise a strong child, or you can raise a child on strong medicine. His entire philosophy was about mitigating any triggers for allergic and asthmatic symptoms. In my book, Clean Design, Wellness for Your Lifestyle, we outline many of those options. It includes getting rid of shag carpet if you still have it. That was a big deal in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, if your pet is inside, make sure they're clean. And the foods that we all eat, and as we talked earlier about, if your gutters are not clean, you want to make sure they're clean so water doesn't start to get into the walls, which can create a mold issue.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Robin. We really appreciate you taking time out of your extremely busy schedule to be with, and hopefully we won't wait as long to kind of have you back again.
Very appreciated.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Robin Wilson is a nationally recognized eco-friendly lifestyle brand owner and an interior designer, and she has 20 years of experience advocating for clean construction and design methods through her firm, Robin Wilson Home.